Shishanyavadi Paskatya De Satarini. Monday Hum Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Sacha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Sacha Manchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhavyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's February 5th, 2016. Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy, Text 27 to 28. I think we'll just, we could recite all of it. Well, should we recite just 27 or both? Atabi pretam aviksha. Brahmano Madhusudana. Visana cheta samtena. Kalparvati karambasa. Loka samstana vijnana. Atmana parikidyata. Tamaha gadaya vacha. Kasmalam shamayamiva. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord saw that Brahma was very anxious about the planning and construction of the different planetary systems and was depressed upon seeing the devastating water. He could understand the intention of Brahma, and thus he spoke in deep, thoughtful words, removing all the illusion that has arisen. Purport. The devastating water was so fearful that even Brahma was perturbed at its appearance and became very anxious about how to situate the different planetary systems in outer space to accommodate the different kinds of living entities, such as the human beings, those lower than the human beings, and the superhuman beings. All the planets in the universe are situated according to the different grades of living entities under the influence of the modes of material nature. There are three modes of material nature, and when they are mixed with one another, they become nine. When the nine are mixed, they become 81, and the 81 also become mixed, and thus we ultimately do not know how the delusion increases and increases. Lord Brahma had to accommodate different places and situations for the requisite bodies of the conditioned souls. The task was meant only for Brahma, and no one in the universe can even understand how difficult it was. But by the grace of the Lord, Brahma was able to execute the tremendous task so perfectly that everyone is amazed to see the workmanship of the Vidata, or the regulator. Ata bipretam anviksha brahmano madhusudanaha vikshana cetasamtena. Kalpa vyati karambasa loka samstana vijnanam atmana prarikidyata tam ahagadaya vacha kasmalam shamayamiva. The Lord said that Brahma was very anxious about the planning and construction of the different planetary systems and was depressed upon seeing the devastating water. He could understand the intention of Brahma, and thus he spoke in deep, thoughtful words, removing all the illusion that had arisen. So Lord Brahma was praying for the ability to create, and the ability to create as an instrument free from pride. And then he looked at the job he had to do, and he felt overwhelmed. He felt overwhelmed. Sometimes we have a job to do in the service of the Lord. We have a service to do, and it may be a service here that only we can do. I mean, maybe ultimately there's no service that only we can do. Krishna can always designate somebody else. But in terms of practical day-to-day life, it may be a service that only we can do. There's nobody else around to do it. And if we don't do it, it certainly appears that it will not get done. We all have these sort of situations. The service that's given to us, nobody else is coming forward to do it. We're the only one who has the training and the tools to do it. And we look at it, the service, and go, what do I do? And he was depressed. He saw all this water of devastation. And just think about for a minute how complicated his job is. So he has to find a way to create the appropriate bodies for each of the living entities according to their previous karma. And each body is a particular combination of the modes of material nature. You know, just on this planet, the biologists, zoologists, botanists, and their entomologists, they're studying the different bodies of the living entities and how each particular kind of body is perfectly suited for a particular atmosphere, just like the seals or walruses, I think they're seals, that live in the Antarctic. They have some special constructions of the body to deal with the very cold water. The water there is basically freezing, and the salt keeps it from turning into ice. So what kind of warm-blooded mammal can stay in surrounded by freezing water? So they have a particular kind of body that's a little different from the seals that live in other parts of the world, that live in warmer parts of the world, right? And we have all different entities, the camels that are designed, they have, you know, eyelashes designed for the desert wind and so forth and so on, even among the human beings. The humans who live in up in high altitudes, like in the Andes Mountains, they have a different kind of, a slightly different kind of lung structure than people who don't live at high altitudes, and they have a different bodily constitution to be able to live at high altitudes without becoming sick. So how amazing, all the different species, some species that are designed to eat, you know, nuts, and some that are designed to eat insects, and some that are designed to eat animals, and some that are designed to eat just eucalyptus leaves, and just unbelievable and amazing, and that's just on this one planet. Scientists have not found all the species on this planet, what to speak of species that are extinct, that used to be on this planet. And then if we take all the other planets and all the different kinds of bodies, it is overwhelming, as Prabhupada said, right? No one in the universe could understand how difficult that would be to make a perfect situation for each desire of each living entity. You know, so I used to run a school, and if you have like 30 kids in the school, we were all different grade levels and all different abilities, and we really tried to have each child have a particular program for them. Out in the world in general, they only do this for children with some sort of learning problem. It's called the special needs. And they create what's called an IEP, individual educational plan, for that student. But even then, frankly, I mean really frankly, they don't have the resources or the time and the energy to get too specific. They're using basically the same books and the same, you know, applying them a little differently for each child, but there's no way that they really can customize education for each child or customize a classroom for each child and their particular needs. But that's what Lord Brahma does. He customizes a body, generally, this species, that species, and then even within the species, of course, there's the individual bodies that are customized according to our particular karma. So I assume all of us listening to this class are human, and yet we each have bodies that are a little different from one another. So even if we're both black men, you know, it's not that the bodies are exactly the same. So we can understand that Lord Brahma was overwhelmed. I mean, I get overwhelmed. I got overwhelmed yesterday just trying to buy an airline ticket, right? So I look, you know, okay, was trying to go to Gaur Purnima in Los Angeles. And I'm thinking, all right, so this ticket gets me to Los Angeles at midnight the day before Gaur Purnima, and it's a middle price. And then this ticket gets me the day before at 5 in the afternoon, but it's a high price. And this ticket gets me to Los Angeles the day after Gaur Purnima, and it's a super sale price. What do I do? Which one do I get? You know, and then they're flashing a sign, only 2 seats left on this flight. And you feel overwhelmed. You just feel, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Right? You just feel overwhelmed. Or sometimes, you know, we have some task in front of us that we have to do. We have to figure out all of our accounting. I was a temple treasurer in 2 different temples. And my husband trained me. You know, the Prabhupada wanted all the accounts figured out to the penny. And it can be overwhelming. You know, you work it out, and my God, you're $40 short, and what are you going to do? And then you figure out that thing, and then you're still $5 short. And, you know, somebody just wrote me an email. She's already in her 30s. She wants to get married, found somebody. Astrology is great. You know, seems like a great match. But her guru told her to preach in such and such country, and the man she found wants her to go to a different country. Oh, what do I do? What do I do? And you feel overwhelmed. You feel overwhelmed. So imagine how overwhelmed Lord Brahma felt. I don't think any of us have ever had anything anywhere approaching the difficulty that Lord Brahma was facing. I mean, we find the difficulties in our life can also feel, though, overwhelming. Just complete, what do I do? How do I do this? Or you look at a job and just say, well, how do I do this? Where do I start? And when we were first doing the Learn to Read series, it was like that. Well, where do I start? What do I do first? Do I have to get this done before this? Do I have to depend on someone else to do that? Can I do this first? And okay, if I've got to wait for this to happen before I do this, but if I wait for this to happen, then I'll lose this opportunity and this bad thing will happen. And you feel overwhelmed, and sometimes you feel kind of paralyzed when you're overwhelmed, right? And sometimes we have decision paralysis. What do I do? What do I do? Or sometimes you just sort of, okay, I'll just do this blindly, right? Oh, I shouldn't have done it like that. So even if it's our service, even if it's our service, and even if we feel that we're Krishna's instrument, we can still get into this place. And Lord Brahma became just depressed. He became just paralyzed. There's just a bunch of water. There's water of devastation everywhere. Where do I start? What do I do? What do I do? How do I go forward in this situation? It says it was so fearful. Lord Brahma was perturbed. He became very anxious. Where do I put the planets? Everything's covered by water. How do I put the planets? How do I make the bodies of the living entities all according to the modes of material nature? So what do we do when we're overwhelmed? How do we deal with overwhelmed? Or, you know, thinking also about Mother Yasoda. Mother Yasoda is feeding Krishna with her breast milk. She's nursing Krishna. And then the milk that's on the stove, that's also for Krishna, starts to overboil. And the acharyas say that the milk was thinking that Mother Yasoda's milk is unlimited and Krishna's belly is unlimited. And so where's my chance to do service? There's this loving, non-envious competition to serve Krishna. So the milk on the stove was for Krishna and her bodily milk was for Krishna. What should she do? What should she do? Should she just let the milk boil over and keep nursing Krishna until he's satisfied? Should she put Krishna down and take care of the milk? And Prabhupada says in that purport that sometimes we have things to do in the Lord's service that appear to be contradictory. And of course, what's interesting about that particular leela is that Krishna got angry at Yasoda's choice. He was displeased. And this example is given by Rupa Goswami as the concept of being favorable, anukulina, that apparently what Mother Yasoda did was not favorable because Krishna became angry, whereas apparently Kamsa's fighting with Krishna was favorable because Krishna enjoyed the fight with Kamsa. But still, Mother Yasoda's action is bhakti and Kamsa's is not, because Mother Yasoda's desire was to please Krishna. So the first step in understanding what to do is to get the desire right. And such was part of Lord Brahma's prayers. We spoke about this very important part of Lord Brahma's prayers. What's my motive? What's my motive? And we talk about this quite a lot, but I think it's very relevant in this case, that unless you can see clearly, you can't make good decisions. And if your motive's off, you can't see clearly. And Prabhupada's talking here about the varieties of delusion that increases and increases. Srila Prabhupada's speaking about the varieties of illusion in the context of the varieties of the living entities, bodies, and planetary situations. But the point can also be applied to Lord Brahma's depression and anxiety and fear and so forth. When we're feeling full of fear and anxiety, then we're not able to understand things as they are. We can't see things clearly. And such is the case even in the most ordinary of situations, that whenever we're very angry or very fearful, we simply lose our ability to gain a broad perspective of the situation. Fear, anger, bewilderment, they narrow our vision and they prevent us from understanding what's going on. We become fixated on our emotions, which take us over. And I've told this story many times, but it bears repeating. My grandson Janu and I were traveling in Tirupati in India. We were there in the winter when it tends to be foggy in the morning, and we left very early to go up the mountain and go see Balaji. So when we left, it was very foggy outside, and it was hard to see. You know, the car's going very slowly. It's very hard to see. And meanwhile, you know, we go up, we see Balaji, we stand in the queue, we stand in the line, we go to many of the other temples up on the mountain, and then we were going to go to some surrounding areas. Well, by that time, the morning had significantly advanced. And as the day advances, generally the sun heats up the atmosphere and the fog dissipates. But when we were in the car, I noticed it was still foggy, and I was thinking, is it actually foggy? It seems, but by now the fog should have dissipated. And I concluded that the fog was not outside the car, but inside the car, that the windshield was fogged up, and the driver was not doing anything to defog the windshield. And when I asked him to defog it, he refused. He thought it would cost him money, like air conditioning. And I had to be quite forceful and tell him we weren't going to drive anywhere until he defogged the window. And when he did that, and then we could see. The fog was inside. So our overwhelmingness comes to a large extent from the fog that's inside. Kama Asha, Krodha Asha. These lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, madness that are motivating us, that they are the reasons for which we do things. That we don't do things out of a desire to please Krishna. We do things out of a desire, basically, for bhakti and mukti. These desires for bhakti and mukti are compared to witches. Now, bhakti and mukti themselves are not witches. Mukti is a great Vaishnavi, as is bhakti or Durga. So these are great devotees. But the desire for them is like a witch that poisons one, or like a ghost that haunts one. So when people get taken over by a disincarnate entity, then they no longer are able to act according to their own desires. Their desires become clouded, or someone takes some intoxicant, someone takes, you know, alcohol or cocaine or heroin or something. These intoxicants cloud their vision, even mild intoxicants like caffeine, nicotine, marijuana. They make one become bewildered so that one doesn't see things in the proper perspective. So anytime we have a desire for anything other than the Lord's service, which is our natural desire, which is the truth, then we become bewildered. The truth is that we are meant to serve the Lord in love, like the hand is meant to serve the stomach, and the hand naturally becomes nourished along with the stomach, and falsity is when the hand tries to serve itself independently of the stomach. You know, if you take your food, you take your potatoes and your chapatis and you rub it into your hands, it's not going to do any good. If you put it in your mouth, you put it in your stomach, then it will nourish the hand. So if our desire is separate enjoyment, and both bhakti and mukti are desires for separate enjoyment. In fact, they're two very different flavors than the desire for love. I really like in Madhava Mahotsava of Jiva Goswami, which is the story of Srimati Radharani getting crowned as the queen of Vrindavan. At the end of the coronation, Srimati Radharani says, "Let all those who are bound be liberated." So this is a great benediction. I was recently reading the story in Gopal Champu about, interestingly, I was also recently listening to Srila Prabhupada tell the story of where Krishna frees the kings whom Jarasandhar had imprisoned. They were imprisoned for a long time, and they were very dirty, they were not very healthy. They were in caves. It wouldn't be a very nice situation for them. So it was Krishna's great mercy that he freed them from their imprisonment. He freed them, he honored them. They were dressed and decorated and honored as befit their position of kings, even though they had been taken down from their positions. This is very wonderful, to liberate somebody. They're the great charities of the world. They do this kind of thing. Read stories about the young girls who are conned or kidnapped and forced into prostitution. And then some charitable person or charitable agency goes and liberates them, buys all of them, or brings in the police or something. And everybody, "Oh, you've liberated them. You've liberated them." How wonderful. People are doing this with animals also. You know, the animals that are bound for slaughter, and they open up the truck and let all the animals go. Right, some years ago here, there was a cow that had was being brought to the slaughterhouse, and somehow she got out of the truck and ran away. She was running down the street. There's a cow running down the street. Nobody keeps cows on the street. But there was a cow running down the street. Somehow she ran into the woods, and she was not found. So we were all happy. Oh, she's liberated. So when Radharani said, let all those who were bound be liberated, her friends and associates, her sakis and manjaris, they became very afraid. They said, we don't want to be liberated. We want to be bound with you in love. When Krishna told Rukmini, you shouldn't have married me. Go, not too late, you can go marry someone else. She fainted. She wanted to be bound. Nowadays, a lot of people don't marry, not because they're renounced, but because they don't want to be bound up with somebody. Right? There's one comedian, he tells it, he says, I love this woman, but I wasn't sure if I really wanted to take the step of marriage, because, half of all marriage lasts for all of your life. So, we don't want to be bound. But that's love. Love is you want to be bound. When you really love someone, you want to be tied to them. You don't want to be free. You don't want them to say, okay, now you're free to go do whatever you want. You want them to say, now I am yours and you are mine. So this desire for liberation, it is a different taste than the desire for bhakti. The desire for sense gratification, it's a different kind of happiness than the happiness of bhakti. Again, even as a mundane example, if I sit down and eat all of the gulabjamans myself, and if I share the gulabjamans with everyone else, the happiness, the kind of happiness that I experience is different. Sometimes we're distributing the prasadam and there's nothing left for ourselves. And there can be a kind of happiness in having distributed the prasadam and seeing other people enjoy it, even if there's nothing left for myself. That's very different than the sense pleasure of eating something myself. So there's different kinds of happiness, different kinds of motives. And one kind of motive is sense pleasure. I want some kind of happiness, one of my senses, or all of my senses, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling. For myself, that is one particular flavor of happiness. Then there's another flavor, and then of course there's billions of subcategories. You can have the taste of ice cream, the taste of pizza, the taste of chilies. You can see the ocean, you can see the mountain, you can see a beautiful human, and so forth. And then there's the taste of liberation, and there's so many different kinds of liberation. Right? There's just ordinary sort of liberation. You pay off your debt, or you get out of a difficult relationship, or you get rid of half the stuff in your closet. There's a kind of liberation when you get free from your body, a kind of liberation where one merges into the Brahman, or even the kinds of liberation where one goes to Vaikuntha. And it's explained by Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur that the four kinds of liberation in Vaikuntha are divided into two main categories. One is where you want to enjoy the Lord's opulence, and one is where you want to serve the Lord, and you also want to enjoy the Lord's opulence, where service is dominant, but you also have some desire for enjoying the Lord's opulence. So that kind of liberation. And then there's the happiness of love and service. So the first thing to do to get rid of our feeling of bewilderment and overwhelmed and in decision making is, what's my motive? To have a motive of love. And if you say, well, I don't have a motive of love, I have a motive of bhakti and mukti, then ask. Ask. Ask Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, please. Oye Vaishnava Thakura, Doya Rasagara. And I am simply running after you, saying, Krishna, Krishna, you have Krishna. You have the power to give me Krishna. And I'm running after you, saying, Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. So to go to Srila Prabhupada, Bhakti Vinod, Narada Muni, our present gurus who are on this planet, and ask, please give me love. Please fill my heart with love. As Prabhupada said, if you have a cup and you keep putting in milk, then if there's some ink in the cup, some dirt in the cup, eventually it will be gone by putting in the milk. So to get rid of the desire for bhakti and mukti is very difficult. But if we fill our heart with the desire for love, loving Krishna, loving the devotees, that happiness, the happiness of giving and serving the Lord and his devotees, so that cleans our consciousness. Because as soon as we have a bhukti or mukti consciousness, because those are unnatural for the soul, and then we don't see things as they are, and our decisions will not turn out very well. And of course, the lower we are in the modes, the more that's operative. It's not black and white. Obviously, the residents of Vaikuntha, who are liberated, they have basically clear vision, even if they have some desire and attachment for liberation. And those, you know, who are grossly in the mode of ignorance, I mean, it's not that they're all in the same category. But proportionately, to the degree that one has love, to that degree one will have clear vision. It's like a windshield can be completely clear, or it can be partially clear. So to get our motives in order, and getting one's motives in order requires a tremendous amount of honesty and humility and a willingness to really see things as they are. Now, the next thing Lord Brahma has here, besides really wanting this mood of service and having his desires correct, is that he also has a mood of compassion and humility. He's really filled with compassion. These prayers that we've been reading of his, he's moved. He cares about the suffering of others. So our decisions will be correct. We'll know what to do if we're full of compassion, if we really care about others. And frankly, most of us in conditioned life, especially in Kali Yuga, we don't really care about anybody. You know, we make a show of caring about this or that, but we really don't. I had an interesting experience in New York last time I was there, that I was speaking about how our fear of death is very much related to losing the identity into which we have poured so many resources and energy during our life. Now, that's really what it is. At death, we lose all the external identity. I was just reading something from Bir Krishna Maharaj. He was saying, at death, we lose everything external that we've done. What we keep is the internal frame of consciousness. So we're pouring our energy into this identity, in our relationships with people, with our possessions, our physical possessions, our particular talents, and so forth, our nationality. And at death, we lose all of that. All of that, Sarvapati Vinirmuktam, you know, it's just taken away. Mritu, aham, Krishna says, I'm death, takes away all of our false upadis. Of course, if we're not a pure devotee, we get another set of them. So one of the participants, one of the people listening to the class, somewhat new to Krishna consciousness, she said, when somebody that we love dies, is it that we're just mourning our identity in relationship to them that's now gone, rather than really mourning them? And I said, yeah. I was like, whoa, that's really the fact. You know, if your child dies, then what are you really mourning? You're really mourning the ability to say, I am so-and-so's parent. You know, I have 4 children. You can't say that anymore. You have to say, I have 3 children. Right? I have 3 living children. That's gone. You know, I can say, I'm the daughter of so-and-so, but those people of whom I'm the daughter, they're gone. That part of my identity, the ability to act in that identity, is gone. I can't, you know, what can I do? I mean, I can do things that would have pleased them in their identity as my parents, but that, you know, and people do that. I want to honor the name of my father, and that's probably a good thing for an ordinary person. But it's not really very meaningful. They're in another body and they don't care. I mean, I'm sure I had children in other lifetimes, and if they're doing something to honor how I felt in those, I don't even know about it. It doesn't have anything to do with me. Right? So that's not really compassion. If I'm upset when someone dies just because that means that little piece of my identity can't function anymore, that's not compassion. Real compassion is I feel others' suffering as my own. I feel others' joys as my own. It's very much a feature of being non-envious. Compassion and envy are diametrically opposed. So to develop this mood of compassion and empathy, and it can be developed, also again through prayer and a desire for it, it can be developed. It's something that can be taught. It's already there in the soul, all of these things. Although it may seem overwhelming to get these things to make the rest of life not seem overwhelming, you know, if I'm going to make my decisions not overwhelming, oh my God, I got to get the right motive and I got to have compassion. Well, that's overwhelming too, but that's really already part of us. And that's something that the Lord and the devotees will give us if we really ask for it. And that's the last thing, is accepting the Lord's help. You know, here the Lord is like, okay, I'm going to help you. Right? I'm going to help you. The Lord cares. He cares. The Lord sees, oh, you're overwhelmed. Dadami buddhi yogam tam. I'll give you the intelligence. I'll clear things for you. You know, I'm riding in the car in Tirupati. I'll clear the windshield for you, I said. I know what buttons to push. And like the back windshield was foggy, but I could see the wires. I said, you know, you can clear that too. He said, no, it doesn't work. I said, no, let me see it. And I just, you know, I had them pull over the car and I got out of the car and I pushed the button. And I knew how to do it. He didn't know how to do it. He drove that car around all the time. But he didn't know how to work it. He didn't know how to clear his own windshield, even though it was his car. But I did. And when he accepted my help, then boom, you know, he could see. Om Agyanatami Vandashag, Anandanashlaka, Chakshirunamitamakina, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So one has to accept Avigachet. One must accept a guru. One as says, I need help. I can't do it myself. I don't know how. I'm overwhelmed even to get the inner clarity that would allow me to know what to do in this overwhelming situation. My situation is overwhelming. The means to conquer it are overwhelming. I'm helpless. I'm stuck. I'm lost. As Prabhupada says many times, the parent is especially inclined towards the little child who's fully dependent on them. Like Ajamila, you know, he's calling to his youngest son. Why? Because he's helpless. He's dependent. You know, here with the family, there's a lot of kids. But there's two of them that are particularly dependent. One's just a little baby, about 5 months old. And she's completely helpless and dependent. I mean, completely. She can't even move around on her own. She can't even get from one place to another. Right? If everybody died and she was the only one living, she would die. She has no means of taking care of herself whatsoever. Right? She doesn't understand what's going on. So therefore, people's attention are particularly towards her, to make sure that she's okay, because she can't do it for herself. And then there's a two-year-old who's a little bit more. I mean, he can, you know, open the doors and walk around and so forth. But even he's very dependent. So everyone's particularly aware. Where is Pitamas? What's he doing? Where is he? Is he okay? You know, we don't so much think like that about the 10-year-old or the 16-year-old. Oh, where is he? What is he doing? Right? So when one has this mood of helplessness, akinchana gochara, and Kunti says, you know, the devotee can only cry to you with sincere feeling when they don't have any other shelter. We don't ask for help if we think we can do it all ourselves. Right? You know, okay, I can do it all myself. One of my grandkids asked me that the other day. He said, Grandma, Can most people fix most things by themselves, or do they need help? And I thought about it for a while. I said, you know, most of us need help with just about everything, at least at some point. Right? So, being willing to ask for help. That means not only humility and honesty, but it also means not having another shelter. Even if superficially one has another shelter, superficially I'm using my body, I'm using my mind, I'm asking for the help of other people, I'm using the machines and the tools that the Lord has given me. But really, oh, it's only Krishna. It's only Krishna. Krishna is the mother, the father, the brother, the grandfather. Krishna is the mind, the intelligence, the ego. Krishna is the gross elements that make up the body. Krishna is the light. Krishna is the heat. Krishna is the air. It's really only Krishna. That I just fully take shelter of Krishna, fully surrender. Sarvadharman prachajamam ekam sharanam vrajam. Without any other designations, without any other duties, Krishna, please help me. Guru, please help me. All the acharyas, please help me. That doesn't mean that I just sit down and stare at the wall and say, please help me. I act, but I act with this mood of dependence. And then, if I have an attitude of service and love rather than bhakti and mukti, if I have a feeling of compassion rather than being self-centered, if I accept the Lord's help, then I will hear the voice of the Lord. Deep, thoughtful words removing all the illusion. Then the difficult becomes easy. As Krishna Das Kaviraj says, if we meditate on Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even the most difficult things become very easy. And if we forget him, even the most easy things become very difficult. Prabhupada talks about all the planning commissions, you know, the United Nations, the planning commissions. Right now in America, we're having a presidential election, and so the different candidates are all promising all kinds of things. And someone sent me this little video. One of the candidates has an advertisement that we're bringing people together, and he's got photographs there of all different varieties of people, colors, shapes, sizes, ages, genders, etc., and all coming together. And the devotee sent it to me because one of the pictures is of a devotee with nice tilak. But I thought, you know, you can't come together like that. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. You can't bring people together on the material platform. If you're keeping the upadis, you are an old black man, you are a young white woman, you are a Hindu, you are a Jew, you are a Christian, you are, then as long as people are in those upadis, on what basis will they come together? What is their common ground? The only way we can really come together and have unity and diversity is on the spiritual platform. So it's really an easy thing to bring people together. It's not hard. We do it in our Krishna consciousness movement all the time. Just like when our temple first opened in Durban, South Africa. So Bhaktivedanta Swami and Bhagavan, that time Maharaj, were there. The white and the black, and this was still the days of apartheid. And we were showing the black and white can work together as friends. The black, the white, the Indians can all work together. One of my good friends, who's a leading preacher, makes a lot of devotees. And she was telling me that if non-Indians visit a temple that's all filled up with Indian families, they'll just think, oh, this is some ethnic Hindu religion, and they won't join. They won't even come. They won't even visit the temple. She says, once somebody becomes a devotee, it becomes irrelevant. And once they're a devotee, whether the temple is filled up with Indian families or Chinese families or Peruvian single men, or it doesn't matter. We have a sense that, oh, we're all worshiping the Lord, and those things are put aside. So what's so difficult, trying to unify the diversity of the world, so difficult. These politicians are struggling, and they will never achieve it. They'll never achieve it on the material platform, just by saying we're all going to work together. Doesn't work. But on the spiritual platform, it becomes easy. It's so easy. I mean, I visit so many temples and centers where there's people from all different nationalities and backgrounds. I just had a visit from my god sister Mekala. She and I were Brahmacharinis together. So her father was one of the leaders of the Palestinian Liberation Army, and my mother was one of the leaders of the Zionist movement. And we used to joke about how our parents practically would have killed each other. You know, our parents would never have approved of our being friends, but we were very good friends and continue so to this day. Or when the Fisher Mansion in Detroit was purchased as a temple. So it was purchased by Lake of Shivanti and Ambarish. Lake of Shivanti gave all of her inheritance money, and Ambarish matched that amount. So Lake of Shivanti's father was a leader in the union movement of labor. And Alfred's four great-grandfather, of course, he was in the management. And there were fights between the Ford Motor Company and, you know, between the parents and the grandparents, etc., of these two devotees. There were fights that were erupted into violence and death. But here these two devotees could work together to buy a temple for Prabhupada, and the media was amazed. How were these two people able to work together? So it becomes impossible out in the world, but in Krishna consciousness it becomes easy. It becomes easy. The example is given by the demigods. There's this great ocean here. Lord Brahma is bewildered by the ocean of devastation. There's this great ocean of the material world. Samsaradava Nalalita Loka. There's a great forest fire. There's a great ocean. Something impassable. Something impassable. Right here in Hawaii, you were right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Impossible. You cannot swim across the Pacific Ocean. Even in a boat or an airplane, it's dangerous. What to speak of swimming? But as soon as you approach the lotus feet of the Lord, the whole ocean becomes as small as the hoofprint of a calf. As soon as you take shelter of the Guru pours the water in the form of rain clouds on the forest fire, and it becomes extinguished. You know, all the firefighters with all of their equipment and their foam, but then as soon as there's rain, it's gone. So this feeling of being overwhelmed is not factual. It's only factual to somebody in illusion. If you're blind, then everything seems overwhelming. But when you have clear vision and the help of the Lord, it's not overwhelming. And you can see clearly. Of course, the devotees, again, are not interested in the kind of happiness enjoyed by those who are liberated, who just know everything like a yogi. Because the devotees are engaged in the Lord's lila. So in the Lord's lila, the knowledge, the understanding, the direction of how to act becomes unfolded as it's needed. And sometimes at the last moment, you know, it makes things more exciting. It'd be kind of boring if you just have this, you know, overwhelming knowledge like Paramatma. Now, Paramatma is the form of the Lord as Paramatma. It's not Akila Rasamrita Murti. It's not all full of all these different rasas. And just to have to be connected with the Paramatma and have all knowledge of everything and have one's overwhelmedness, I'm sure that's not a word, cleared up by connection with the Paramatma, it's not very much fun, you know. Therefore, even Krishna appears to become bewildered when Shalva sends the messenger and kills the false Vasudeva. Krishna appears bewildered. When Satadanva kills Satyajit, Krishna appears bewildered. When the cowherd boys go into the Agasura's mouth, Krishna appears bewildered. When Krishna meditates on how to repay the gopis, he appears bewildered. When Mother Yasoda is running after him with a stick, he appears bewildered. Because it's fun. It's fun. So Krishna removes the overwhelm. He makes everything, as Prabhupada will say, easy as anything. But in a playful way, in an adventure way. Not in just some mystic, boring way. And this is what Lord Brahma is doing, and Krishna is reciprocating. So, questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions?
On the subject of liberation, it seems that it's not unhealthy in the beginning for a devotee to desire liberation from being within this material world. You know, there's famous quotes where Bhaktisiddhanta, for example, said that this world is no place for a gentleman. But yet we know at the same time, I guess in the highest sense, we have examples of people like Vasudeva Bhatta that said, you know, let me stay here and suffer the karma of every living being. So, you know, but often we hear devotees say, if you talk about, you know, that this is a nasty place and Kali Yuga is increasing in intensity, and we should want to get out. But you know, they will say, no, that's not a, we shouldn't think that way. But what are your thoughts?
There are things that are helpful at certain stages that have to be jettisoned at other stages, and I often refer to Bhaktivinoda Thakura's book, Bhakti Loka, where in the section on Niyamagraha, he talks about different rules and different principles for different stages. And he says that when you're ready to progress to the next step, if you maintain attachment to the rules of the previous step, then those rules act as chains around your feet. So it's very, very important that one act according to where one is and that one then take the next step to progress. I mean, just like bhukti. Bhukti is accomplished, material enjoyment is accomplished through varnashram. Varnashram is the vehicle for pious sense enjoyment in relationship with the Lord, for good karma. That is what Varnashram is all about. It's not really about anything else. So if somebody's just living a sinful, unregulated vikarma life, then it's not a bad thing for them to become attached to Varnashram. It's not a bad thing at all. However, becoming attached to Varnashram is a terrible thing if you want bhakti, because all of Varnashram is based on upadis. Each of the varnas and each of the ashramas are upadis, are upadi, right? Like Lord Chaitanya says, I'm not any of these things. So why encourage somebody to take up a designation? I mean, right now people are running around the planet. They're not thinking, I'm a Brahmin, Kshatriya, I'm a Brahmacharya, I'm a Grahastha. Why do we want to put a designation on them that they're going to have to jettison later? Because it may be useful at that particular state for the people in general. It's a lot better than unregulated life. Saying to people, you know, now you're young, you should get married, you should have kids, you should have an income, which is what everybody used to be told, you know, 50, 60 years ago, is much, much better than saying to people, just do whatever you want. Just have illicit sex, you know, kill the babies, get a nice place for yourself, be irresponsible. So it's far superior. And, you know, this is a theme I talk about a lot. What's the best thing and what's best for me now? So for somebody just totally immersed in trying to enjoy their senses, it may be very useful to say to them, hey, you should want to get free of this. And we find the Shastra, even the Bhagavatam, which Kaitava Dharma, Prajita, throws out cheating religion, but even the Bhagavatam offers benedictions that appear to be within the realm of bhakti and mukti. And our acharyas, Srila Prabhupada, they talk about bhakti and mukti. And I was just hearing yesterday, you know, Krishna wants the living entities to be happy even in this life. That's bhakti. But Krishna doesn't want us to suffer even in this life. And yes, Krishna wants us to be liberated from the modes of material nature. Just this morning I was hearing Prabhupada saying, without being liberated from the modes of material nature, you can't actually perform bhakti. And it's natural in the beginning. I don't know, healthy, but it's natural that somebody comes with one of those desires. Desire for bhakti, desire for mukti, curiosity. But that's natural. It's not a disqualification for beginning. But we should understand that the desire for liberation is contrary to the desire for love. It's contrary. It's opposite. It's opposite. If a husband says to his wife, my greatest desire is for freedom, she'll become terrified. She wants him bound to her. Otherwise, what is the meaning of love? Just like nowadays people, you know, have so-called love without marriage. But there's no meaning. If no one's bound. Now, there's a marriage ceremony. We take a vow. Till death do us part. I'm bound to you. You're bound to me. Riches and poverty and sickness and health. We're bound to each other. That's love. So the desire for liberation is opposite from the desire for love. Now, interesting, Prabhupada says the need of the soul is for complete freedom. So all the desires, everything that one attains through bhakti and mukti is achieved through bhakti. Someone who's full of bhakti, they're not really bound by anything except voluntarily out of love. They're not really bound at all. And they certainly have all sense pleasure. We offer our food in sacrifice. We get to eat the food, and not only do we get to eat the food, it tastes better after you offer it to Krishna. We all have this experience. So those things aren't denied, bhakti and mukti, sense pleasures and freedom. We're all anandam maya vyasat, we're all pleasure seeking, we all seek freedom. This is natural for the soul. But our motive, our driving motive, should be love. And until and unless we come to that and give up wanting to taste freedom and sense pleasure separately from love, we'll not achieve clarity in our vision. We'll not achieve this freedom from being overwhelmed and distressed and depressed, because wanting those things separately from Krishna is contrary to love. They're incompatible.
Two visions came to my mind as you were describing how we have to give up an earlier stage to go on to the next stage. It just sort of came in my mind as you were speaking. One is, we see these rockets. When they fire off the rocket, they have that first stage that gets it to a certain stage in the atmosphere, and then that stage of the rocket falls off, and then the rocket's, you know, beyond gravity or wherever it is, and then it continues yes. on, but it's got to drop that first stage. And another vision was, I remember when I was a young child learning to ride a bicycle, they had those little training wheels in the back, those little extra set of wheels that balanced the bicycle. And then I remember at a certain stage, my father said, now it's time to take them off. And I was almost mortified that they were coming off. But he took them off. He knew it was the right time and the right stage. And I remember him walking real fast with the bike to get it going. And he just launched me off. And there I was without the wheels. And I could see, yes, this was the next stage of this wheel. It was definitely time for the wheels to go.
It's funny, I have an almost identical memory with my father in a bicycle. And I can, again, see the very street that we were on, my father running beside the bicycle, and so forth. The same, you know, when a child's learning how to walk, at a certain point you take away your hand. At a certain point, you know, the child isn't holding on to something. Okay, so Harsh is asking a question about the sparrow trying to get the ocean in Garuda, and did the sparrow ask for help? I'm not sure whether or not the sparrow asked for help, but in any case, the Lord's helping everyone. The Lord isn't only helping the devotees, the Lord also helps Matasmati Ganava Pohanam Cha. Krishna is giving intelligence, knowledge, and forgetfulness to everyone. Krishna is the ability in man, Krishna is our intelligence, Krishna is our strength. Without Krishna's help, nobody's doing anything. So the Lord is helping everyone. But if we want the Lord's help to see things clearly, if we want the Lord's help to become free from being overwhelmed in our service, we need to ask for it, as Lord Brahma did. We need to ask for that specific help. Such are in the great prayers of the Acharya. Mahalakshmi says, what does it take to get rid from the identification from the previous ashram, which not longer apply to the present one? It seems that the movement from one ashram to another is gradual. Most changes in the material world are gradual. Just like the right now, you know, the sun is rising, but it was a gradual thing. Even here, close to the equator, where we have a relatively short dawn and twilight, still it's gradual. It's not like it's pitch dark and poof, there's the sun. So from the Brahmacharya ashram to the Grihastha ashram, it's gradual. There's some period of engagement. In the old system, there was child marriage, and the boy and the girl gradually got to know each other. They didn't live with each other till after puberty, and then Prabhupada says the girl would still go home and visit her parents periodically, going back and forth. It was a gradual transition. In the pre-industrial society, the grown children lived with the parents. Usually it was the boy, but not always. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had his daughter and his son-in-law live with him. But the children, the grown-up married children, they were part of the household of the parents. So they weren't really running everything until the parents, you know, retired or died. So it wasn't until somebody was like 40 years old that they were really in charge of everything. It was a very gradual transition to grihastha life. And there's usually a gradual transition to vanaprastha life. You know, again, in the traditional system, husband and wife start turning things over to the older children, who they've trained for so many decades, and they travel for a while, then they come home, then they travel for a while, and they come home. You know, there's stages. Sannyas life, there's stages. Prabhupada talks about the sannyasi who gets a little house outside the village, and his children bring him food. Right, and he begs door to door. Then he travels and preaches. Then he's just a recluse, separate from the world, as the Paramahamsa. So there's stages. It's not sudden. One lovely devotee that I know had a husband who tried to suddenly take vanaprastha. He was living with her as a grihastha. And he told her when he married her, you know, when I'm 50, I'm going to take vanaprastha. And, you know, she didn't think it would be the way he did it. On his 50th birthday, he just said goodbye and walked out the door. Never communicated with her again for a couple of years. And she just panicked. It took her a while to get her footing and become stable. Later he contacted her and he apologized. But these things should generally be done gradually. You know, gradually you let go as you're ready to. And it's interesting when Vasudeva is preaching to Kamsa, and he's talking about how we change our bodies, and Prabhupada explains there, and the Acharyas explain there, that we don't generally let go of one body until we're firmly situated in the next. You know, you put down your foot and then you take up the back foot. So embrace the attributes of where you're going, and then naturally and gradually the attributes of the previous ashram will fall away. You know, if the person who's getting married, if they really accept what the marriage entails. I mean, I meet so many couples who say, oh, we don't want to have children because they're going to interfere with our sadhana. Well, what kind of a householder are you anyway then? And Prabhupada says, you know, grihastha life means wife, children, home. He said, why are you trying to make it something else? And people who are, you know, artificially, we're not going to have children because they're a burden, renunciation, and a load of passions. It's troublesome. You know, or I'm not going to really spend time with my wife, or I'm not going to really spend time with my husband. My husband's Maya, my wife's Maya. I'm just going to spend all my time at the temple doing service. And then you don't make the transition properly. You know, or I don't want to have a proper income. Then you don't. And then you don't get the full benefit of that ashram. Or, you know, I want to be a vanaprastha or sannyasi, but I still want to keep attraction to the opposite sex on a subtle level, and attraction to a lot of money and a lot of prestige. These are the things that Raghunathas Goswami Bhaktivinoda Thakur talk about in Manashiksha as a kind of deceit, a kind of pretense where you pretend you're doing something but you're really doing something else. But that's mostly how you do it. You embrace bit by bit the ashram that you're going into, and it's probably not going to happen overnight. I mean, in my own experience of moving from the grihastha ashram to the vanaprastha ashram, which I've been in now for 20 years. So I'd say it was probably a 5 to 10 year transition period for me. I don't know how my husband would describe it, but it was a very gradual kind of transitional period where you gradually take on the austerities and the lifestyle of the new ashram. So Radha Rupini says that makes so much sense, not shocking and disturbing. Yes, we shouldn't. Prabhupada says everyone should clean their heart gradually and not abruptly. So even if there's some abrupt incident, which happens, just like Vidura, you know, there was an abrupt incident that Duryodhana said, throw out the son of the kept maidservant and keep him with only his breath. And Vidura said, okay, time to be a vanaprastha. You know, but in one sense, that was gradual, because the problem with Duryodhana had been there for a long time. It wasn't just like that came out of the sky. It wasn't like there was a good relationship with everybody, and then it was some big surprise. But there may be some incident, you know, the incident when Prabhupada's wife was too lazy to cook because her cook was sick. And so instead of cooking, she sold Prabhupada's Bhagavatam for tea biscuits. And that was a precipitating incident that pushed Srila Prabhupada. Okay, now it's really time to take vanaprastha. But still, that was gradually happening. You know, or King Anga, who saw the activities of Vena and decided at one point, okay, I'm going to do it. So there is a moment, you know, there's a moment where there's the wedding. That happens at a particular moment. There's the moment where you go through the sannyas ceremony. But there's usually something leading up to that. And almost always, if we're perceptive, then we'll see, we'll be aware, wait a minute, you know, this is I'm preparing for another stage of life. And even after that moment, it's still gradual. Just because there's the wedding doesn't mean, boof, you know, at that particular moment, the full relationship of the grihastha ashram is fully and completely established. It's something that grows on you. Just you take sannyas, it's not okay, wow, I'm immediately at the Paramahamsa stage even after taking the sannyas. So even if there's some shocking incident that precipitates a change, you know, even if that happens, still there can be some gradual acceptance. And these shocking incidents sometimes happens because, you know, Krishna wants to push us to do something. Generally, these shocking incidents happen because we were resisting change. That the change was obvious, or should have been obvious. We should have taken the step voluntarily and gradually, and we didn't. And so Krishna gives us a strong push. Another reason that there's these shocking incidents is so people won't criticize. Because for many of us, if we make these changes in our life, changes in ashram or whatever, changes in that, I mean, ashram is all still external and material. Changes in our practice of bhakti also. So for many of us, if we make these changes just naturally and gradually according to our inner inspiration, people may criticize. And if there's some shocking incident, then they'll say, oh, well, you know. Like I remember we were running the school in Detroit, and it was becoming more and more obvious to us that it wasn't the right situation for us, you know, that we needed to move on. But we had this strong sense of responsibility. Well, we have this service, we're the only ones who are doing it, it's for Prabhupada, and et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a shocking incident with a crazy fellow, for lack of a better term, it's probably not politically correct, but anyway, there was a man who had a long, 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 long history of violence in many different places and been banned from many temples, and he just went bananas one day and just attacked the teachers and the children publicly. It was, and we went to the police, and the police said, I'm sorry, you know, we have a busy crime-ridden city, we can't do anything to help you. Okay, now it's time to, you know, I asked all the GBC, and they said, oh, Krishna's telling you it's time to move on. And I felt that was a way that we could move on where nobody could blame us. Nobody could say, oh, you've neglected your duty, you've given up your duty. You haven't, you should stay longer. But everybody could understand, okay, this is a sign from Krishna that it's not safe to stay here anymore, that it's time to move on. You know, or probably the temple in Jhansi failing in India, and it was a sign, okay, I'm supposed to move on. So, and nobody could blame Prabhupada, nobody could say, oh, you didn't try hard enough in India. You need to try harder. Oh, okay. It's time to go on. So these shocking incidents are not necessarily bad. They may push us to do something that we were resisting to do. They may provide a means for other people not to be critical of us. Of course, sometimes, you know, people can be critical of anything. They can say, oh, well, it's not real because there was a shock. Yeah. You're not a real renunciate. It's so ridiculous, you know, but anyway. Prabhupada's not a real renunciate because he had a bad wife. If he had a good wife, he wouldn't have any. This is stupid. So people can criticize anything. But what to do? So we could take one more question if anyone else has another question or comment. Okay, thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki.